did one. Come on in. That's you there.
See those headphones?
Oh, yeah, well, the full experience I shall have, thank you.
Glass of water.
I always put the headphones on. Do you put the headphones on when you do radio?
Always.
I always put the headphones
on.
Of course I do.
I love it.
Sounds so much better.
Sounds so much better. It's the direct opposite when you used to play with the tape recorder when you were a kid and listen back and go,
that's not me, is it?
Yeah. Unless you go, yeah, that's how I sound.
That's exactly my dulcet tone. Thank you.
It's lovely.
David Tennant does a podcast with
Catherine Tate.
So, Catherine, you've just finished a big tour and a West End run of The Catherine Tate Show.
I have.
Yeah. Full of characters you've been doing for, some of them for like 15, 20 years now?
Definitely not 20 years.
No?
20 years.
Is that not possible?
For sure. No, it's definitely not. Partly because, you know, when I did the TV show, I'd never really done any of those characters.
Had you not? No, some of them predated it,
didn't
they?
Some of them did. I mean, I did the old lady character, a version of it doing stand-up. So probably in that, but I never came out as a character in stand-up. But I used to do that old lady voice when I was doing stand-up. And that would have probably been about...
There you go. Just about. 20,
yeah, maybe. Yeah.
And that was the first time you'd sort of taken it on tour like that?
Yes. I should have done it a long time ago, but I didn't, you know. And then when they said, well, do you want to do it? I was thinking, well, I don't know if anyone's going to care or remember. And
they did, though.
And they did. And that was lovely. And now I can put it to bed because it was all new material, but it was existing characters.
Does it feel like the end of a chapter rather than the beginning of a new touring chapter?
Beginning of a new touring chapter where, as I've said before, if I carry on doing it, I will need prosthetic for the teenager and no prosthetic for the old lady.
Well, you did do the old lady without prosthetics,
didn't
you?
I did, yeah.
But that was just
it was
practicalities.
Simply because the only time I felt self-conscious about it, funnily enough, was in the West End, because before that we'd been playing such much bigger venues.
Right.
And we realised you couldn't do the intricate prosthetic that takes an hour and a half to put on. And all the kind of crude versions that pulled over your head that we tried prototypes of, just didn't work. I looked like Hannibal Lecter in a lot of them. And it was more disorientating than actually that beyond the first three rows, you couldn't notice anyway in most of the venues we were playing. Apart from the fact that when I walked through the audience, because I come in as in Australia, they kept going. As I was walking through the audience, everyone's like, oh, hello, hello.
Yeah.
In Australia, they kept going, oh, Nen, you look so young. And I'm like, shut up. Don't draw attention to that. Nen's had a facelift. But it was just practicality, and you realised it was the live version of the character.
And in a big venue, it's more like that kind of silhouette with the hair.
Yes, exactly. And the prosthetic does an awful lot. But I mean, obviously, it's absolutely far more scundering when people don't realise you're not wearing.
Yeah, quite. Was there? Did your vanity take a hit? Go, apparently, I can get away with this.
Apparently, this
I can
is all
play
right.
An octogenarian
with no help whatsoever.
it was sort of a greatest hits tour, wasn't it? You were kind of
yes, but none of the material. Had
no,
been
no,
seen
of course.
Before.
But all those characters. I mean, people were sort of waiting for the characters that they love to come out.
I suppose so. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you see it as a way of saying goodbye to a lot of those characters?
Yes and no.
Never say never,
David. No, never say never. Because I'm actually, I've written a Nan film.
Fantastic.
Which is great fun.
Yes.
And I do think that's probably the one that, you know, as we like to say in the business, has got the legs to carry on.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably the most popular character. After many years, as you say, of not doing it, just doing like Nan specials, of suddenly coming back and going, oh, I remember this, and it was great. But I'm not in any way sentimental about work. So, you know, I leave a job and go, yep, that was nice. I don't.
Even though these characters are from you.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm glad that they're there, and I've loved doing them, and I'm so grateful and appreciative that people still love them. But I never held on to them. I was never thinking, oh God, I hope I go out and say I'm a bothered again or anything like that. It gone.
Did they sort of slightly haunt you? Were you kind of... Because you always play with that when you do Lauren, the schoolgirl character, in the show.
Yes.
You play with the bit where you go, I ain't saying it yet.
Yeah.
Like you were kind of playing with people's expectation and a sense that...
Actually, I remember us doing a broadcast thing where you had said... at the time, because it was at the time of Doctor Who,
yeah.
and you saying from a career point of view, I feel like my epitaph's already been written.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, and yeah. I felt like that with Emma Bob. You know what I mean? And it's that thing. And it's the twofold thing of going, how lucky
to have an epitaph at all.
Lucky to have something that where people go, oh yes, I remember them. And at the same time, it is that thing of going, I would quite like to do other things.
Yeah.
But it's certainly not being disingenuous about them. I think it just sat quite neutrally with me. I neither missed it or felt that it had outstayed its welcome. But I am aware that, and because of YouTube and Facebook and things, people that I know would have been far too young when my show came out know who I am because of this, you know, because of little bite-sized bits of pop culture, I suppose, that come around.
A bazillion views on YouTube now.
Which is, of course, an extraordinary thing.
So when you were thinking of, when acting became a thing for you and you thought you were going to drama school, presumably the notion was never, oh, one day I'll have an almost rock star-like comedy tour. Presumably it was more, I'm going to be Hedda Gabler.
You know, or even, will I get a regular on the bill? Not that having a regular on the bill was a low bar at all, because I was on the bill quite a few
times.
You
practically were a regular.
I mean, it was like a job for life.
Every couple of months?
When I left drama school, which was in the mid-90s, 94, if you'd been out of the bill for 8 months, you could go in again as another character.
Could you time it that?
Well, you just got a call.
You were just aware that...
You just got a call and went, oh, you can go up for another part in the bill. And right. I was about four different parts in the bill.
Although were they all kind of the same?
No, I don't think they... Well,
did you show your range?
I mean, I don't know that I had much of a range. I think it's... I never played a criminal. I was always, you know, the victim.
Right.
I think at one point I've played a young PC. But I think in all of the characters... I always said he was last seen going around the Jasmine Allen estate. He's not from round here. It was that part, the Jasmine Allen estate.
Yeah.
It was set on the Jasmine Allen estate. He was last seen.
Did everything happen there? Was that part of their fictional hood?
He was last seen around the Jasmine Allen estate. He's gone round the back. It was always, he's gone round the back.
But you did play a young PC as well.
I think I
did. You were seconds away from being a regular.
I was.
That could have been a very different career trajectory.
It could have been.
Yeah.
I remember I got the job while I was still at drama school.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, I got the...
Did that make
filming.
You...
Oh, I mean, it was like I lauded it above me.
Yes, your classmates must have been furious.
We were still doing, like, you know, the showcases that you do in the third year, where for all the agents coming to see, and like I'd rock up and go, I'm sorry, I've had like costume fittings. Yeah, sorry. Oh, God, sorry. Sorry, it's just the first. I'm talking about my call time. Oh, God. Oh, you'll probably find out about this when you leave.
But didn't you... You auditioned for drama school four times.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. I started... 17, 18, 19. Yeah, because I started when I was 17, and I went when I was 20.
Right. What was going wrong?
I think... I don't know.
Did you lose heart? Did it?
Yes, I did lose heart.
Right.
I did lose heart.
But you kept going back.
I kept going back, yeah. For the school I went to, I was probably too young at 17.
Right.
You know, to be fair to them, they didn't ever, and the heartbreak of it was, I used to always get down to like the final bit. The audition process was the survival of the fittest, and it was hard.
Right.
It was really hard,
and
it appealed to me because I'm actually quite competitive.
Uh-huh.
And what they would do is, in a single day, they would whittle down 30 people to four. And it would literally, and someone would come in, so there'd be 30 of you first of all, and then someone would come in with a list of names, and they'd call off the list of names, and then they'd say, these people go to that room and these people go to that room. And some people were just being told to go and the other people had been told...
So you didn't know what was in the room when you got there?
No, you didn't know you were in the room until you get to the room... And there's more people than there are than in the other room. And you can hear the cheers in the other room.
Oh.
Because they've got in.
That is brutal.
And it was brutal. And it was brutal. And for 3 years, I was in the room right at the last day where I heard the cheers of the other people. And it was hard, but it gave me the taste of the blood.
Did it really?
Yeah.
You thought, I'm not giving up on this.
And to be fair to them, they always did say to me, you're not ready yet, come back. It's not like on the first, you know, it wasn't like the first audition of X Factor where they go, stop, go away.
Right.
You've not got a chance.
No, it was like much more like week it eight was, when it all gets really personal.
Yeah, oh no, it was boot. I got through boot camp.
Yeah.
You know, I was at the judges' houses.
Yeah. You're having tea with Simon.
Yeah, I was having tea with Simon and he was telling me, I can't take you through. So
did it just make you determined?
Yes, or it did.
Would you have a cry?
Never had a cry. I remember one time going back to the audition panel and laying into them.
Wow.
And it was the year before I got in and I just went...
What did you say?
I can't remember what I said because I didn't plan it, but I just remember going, I mean, something, you know, obnoxious and teenage, probably like, you're going to regret this. You don't know what you're doing. You know, exactly as they do when they come back in to Simon Cowell.
Yeah. Yeah.
On the first go. Yeah, I'm going to be a big star.
And did you have a sense of what kind of actor you were planning to be?
I always knew I had a facility for comedy.
Right. And you'd sniffed out the power of that as a kid,
Absolutely had.
Right.
And I also knew, because also before I went to drama school, I did a bit of performing because because it was the 90s and I did improvisation
as a
shows.
Kid?
No, before I went to drama school.
Oh, you mean in that, right, your late teens.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And I remember being in my third year doing a bit of stand-up and on the circuit was Matt Lucas doing his character Sir Bernard Chumley.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
But your stand-up wasn't in character.
No, it wasn't. No, it was never in character. No, it was just
What stand-up. Sort of material were you doing?
It was all kind of, you know, as Alan Partridge would say, telling an observation.
Right.
It was very... Well, and I think it's stand-up is still like that. You know, that it was the political stuff had gone, you know, the surreal stuff wasn't really there. I mean, it was that Eddie Izzard was doing it and probably Ross Noble, but it was just being yourself. And what I found I also had a facility for was comparing. Because comparing, you don't really need material. You just need to have the guts to just go out and speak to people and work a room, really. What it did was when I got to drama school, I think I had a tiny bit of an edge in things like impro, which most actors find very frightening anyway, and especially when, you know, when you've just got there. And I liked that. But I also noticed that I would always veer towards comedy.
Right.
You know, in an improvisation, you know, and most improvisations at drama school are not comedy because they don't really touch on comedy. No one teaches comedy, it doesn't seem. But I would realise I would always hijack the scene towards the punchline.
Right.
That I would deliver.
You were fearless when you got to drama school, you mean? You just had a fearlessness.
I don't know that it was necessarily fearlessness. I think there was a cockiness that had come from having done a fair bit of performing.
Right.
And I'd done a lot of performing at youth theatre. So
performing had never made you particularly nervous? You know, it had just been...
No.
Right.
No. Extraordinarily, given I was a painfully shy child.
Right.
I mean, to the point where if you'd have gone back to my 10-year-old self and pointed out people in the class and said, oh, actually, this person's going to get their own... They're going to get a TV show.
Yeah.
And they'd have gone, I mean, 100% not, because as you notice, she cannot open her mouth without stuttering or going red. And
right.
Yeah, I mean, I was just petrified.
But so what, how did you, was it just performing released you in a way?
I don't know. And yet I think it was this thing that I've always had, which is bizarrely, even though I was incredibly shy and incredibly... I lacked an awful lot of, I don't know whether it was esteem or self-confidence, but at the same time, I'm extremely competitive.
Right.
I'm extremely competitive. And what it was, I think I'd look at people and go, I know I can do better than that. I can do better than you. Why are they saying you're good? And yet, at the same time, but this is how, really, I kind of think, I don't really know how it happened. I can remember the fear... The absolute dread and fear of like family parties when it came around and they go, oh, let the kids get up and do something.
Right.
You know, where like the kids would be encouraged to get up and do a turn. And I remember the fear and the dread of going and hiding away and thinking one day I'll be old enough where I can turn around and say, no, I'm not doing this. I don't have to do it. And it's strange that then somehow that became my... way through it.
Yeah. And so when did you first start realizing you could do it?
I think performing for me came through being at school And I found that being the funny one was a safe way to identify myself because it made me in control of how people would identify me. Because if, you know, if you're 13, you get everyone gets labelled.
Mm.
And rather than being the ginger one or the shy one, you know, or the specky one, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Or the fat one or the one who can't do that, I thought I'm going to be the funny one.
So you knew that you had the capacity to be funny. You knew your brain worked in that way.
I suppose I did, but it only came about saying something out loud in class and it got a laugh. And I remember like suddenly I kind of like primed like a,
right,
you know, like a wild animal. I was like, what? What was that? What was that?
Sniffing it.
And then I realised, okay, I could be a bit of a jester. But I think what I sensed most of all was a sense of protection.
So it was a survival instinct.
Yes, absolutely survival instinct. Because what you can do is disarm people.
Mm.
And I was, for a brief time, I was definitely the target of awful teenage girl,
right,
you know, mm, insidious bullying, like passing notes and, you know, because, you know, really the dread. And awful. And I turned it around.
Right.
And just got into a new group of people and almost within my own, well, actually, yeah, within my own school and within my own class, I rebranded myself.
Really consciously?
I think so, yeah. And then at that point on, I think I became known as the funny one.
Mm.
And yet then when I went to, I did dot around a lot of schools.
Right.
Dotted around a lot of schools. But then when I went to a boys' school, I didn't want to be the funny one anymore.
Sure.
I didn't want to be the funny one. No, I wanted to be Kylie Minogue. Sure. Well. Do you know what I mean? And because I was one of a few girls in a boys' school, I let all that go.
Why did you end up at a boys' school?
Oh, I think I got expelled from the convent.
Oh, so you were quite a...
Did you know what? I wasn't a troublemaker. What I'd done is I'd said I wanted to be an actress.
Mm-hmm.
And what the nuns heard was prostitute. Do you know what I mean? Oh, God alive, she wants to be a prostitute.
Right.
And I didn't, obviously. I just wanted to be
there was different. There are different jobs.
There are different. And I think they suddenly thought, we don't know what to do with her. We don't know what to do in terms of we can't help her achieve this goal.
Mm-hmm.
And so they sent me off to another school, but this was full of boys.
Who were the performers that you thought, oh, that looks like,
well,
something
the thing
do,
that or... absolutely hooked me was a show called Girls on Top.
I remember
that. Yeah, Girls on Top. And it was because it was four women.
Right.
It was French and Saunders, Tracy Ullman and Ruby Wax.
Yes, I remember.
And it was so extraordinary to me. I just loved it. And I also remember watching, although not entirely understanding, but I knew it was good. And it was a sitcom from America, and it was called Soap.
I love that too.
Yeah. With Billy Crystal.
Yeah.
And the puppet,
yeah,
the ventriloquist dummy. And I just remember it. And funny, and that is where I got my name. This is a story of two sisters, Jessica Tate and Mary Campbell.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Because you had to change your name for union reasons.
For legal reasons.
For legal reasons. Yeah.
But those American shows were just so, so seductive to me as a kid.
Mm.
I just loved them. Starsky and Hutch.
Really?
Oh, God, I love Starsky
Which
and
one
Hutch.
Did you fancy?
Oh, I don't know. I don't know. Huggy Bear.
He was very cool.
He was so cool. And it was always, it was the two Ronnies and then Starsky and
That's
Hutch.
That's right, yeah.
Two Ronnies and Starsky and Hutch.
With the Generation Game before that and Doctor Who before that.
Well, you see,
That's
afraid,
you tuned in later.
I'm afraid I was watching Basil Brush on the other channel. Which, as we know, I've made no bones about.
No,
my...
you no. We'll get to that.
About my,
yeah.
No, yeah, absolutely. It was appointment viewing.
And were you going to the movies as well?
He used to go to the cinema a lot. Also, because we lived in central London, I used to go to the theatre a lot.
Well, right. What sort of things would you go and see?
Musicals.
Okay.
And I remember the first time seeing Annie. And then that was it. That was like, well, there's me.
Right.
That's me on stage.
Yes.
And I also saw, I think this is correct, and this would have been in about the mid-80s, Mickey Dolans, who was in The Monkees.
Yes.
He directed Bugsy Malone.
Yes.
With a group of kids, as was the film. And my mum said to me, I looked at your face as you were watching the show, and she said, and I knew I'd lost you. I'd lost you to the theatre. And at that point, I then started doing National Youth Theatre, and I used to be a part of a group in the East End called the Curtin Youth Theatre, and that did shape and change my life, definitely.
So were you the kid watching the show and loving it, but also a bit angry that those kids were up there and you weren't?
Oh, just like, I don't even think I'd got to that point. I was just enthralled with it at that point. So I didn't really have this, I could do that, because I was still so shy. I thought, I don't think then I was thinking I can do that. I was then thinking, how can I do that? Do you know what I mean? But I know I want to do that.
Yeah.
But people that...
I think I saw that same production.
Did you?
I think it toured to Glasgow.
Really?
I remember Mickey DeLenz being involved somehow.
Yes.
But then after drama school, so you left drama school early to work on The Bill and you were...
Oh, no. I did the job within my last term. Do you see what I mean? Okay. So I was like flitting backwards and forwards. Oh. Even worse.
You know what I mean? Much worse. Did that make you think this is going to be easy?
I think what it was when I left, I kind of went from one job to the next job, like little parts in TV shows, and that does lull you into a false sense of security. Mm. And then I got a theatre job. Then I did Arthur Miller's All My Sons with the Oxford Touring Company.
Okay,
did that, and then I went into the National for a year.
Well, you were understudying.
I was a small part and understudying. Yeah. Yeah, your classic job out of college. Yeah. Unless you were incredibly...
Yes. But were you fine with understudying, or was that frustrating? Or
it was...
Were you just so delighted to be at the National Theatre that it...
I was bored.
Okay.
I was so bored. I was really bored. Because the thing about it is, you rarely get to go on.
Did you get to go on at all?
I did.
Okay.
Yeah, I did get to go on.
Okay.
In fact, I was understudying Marianne Jean-Baptiste.
Mm, very posh.
Yes. But by and large, I was very bored. I mean, I had a great time. It was fun and you get to dress up and, you know, they put loads of different wigs on you and it was fine.
So you were in the shows. You were sort of delivering trays.
I was maids, exactly. Uh-huh. A little part. I remember I had a little scene with Geraldine McEwan in Way of the World.
Lovely. So at that point, you are still doing a bit of stand-up.
I didn't do stand-up properly until I left the show at the National because, of course, your evenings are
done. No, you don't
done.
Have the time,
You don't
I
have the time. And it was when I left there, I think I started doing it properly because I realised, oh, God, I just thought, I don't want to do this. And then I think they asked me to stay on and do something else. I was like, no, I don't want to do this. I don't want to this define me. Actually, it was the year I got nominated for the Perrier that the RSC came a-knocking. And instead of pursuing my comedy then, I decided to just go and do the RSC.
Right. Yeah. Because that still felt like where you ultimately wanted to be.
Yeah, for sure.
So the comedy was always a means to an end, was it?
Yes, I think it was. It was just about generating my own work. And it was about being where I wanted to be, but having to go a different route, you know, because I just wasn't on the list until I started doing comedy. I just wasn't on the list of... Because obviously, you know, you come out of drama school, it's a saturated market.
Quite.
And, you know, there's 3 years above you and 3 years waiting to come up. There's many young people coming out of drama school, you know. And I had to go and do the thing that slightly set me apart. And I do think at the time, on the stand-up track, I was fast-tracked a bit.
Why was that?
Because I was perhaps a little bit different I didn't come on about do stuff about being a woman.
Right.
Or being a girl. You know, I came on and I was fairly gladiatorial and I used to really like and enjoy the hard gigs, the gigs that you had to be tough for, like in Edinburgh doing Late and Live, which was a notorious bear pit.
Because the hecklers came to be part of the
Absolutely.
Show.
Absolutely. I mean, they would decimate you. Yeah. And there was also a club called Up the Creek in South London. Up the Creek, there was a level of heckling that had street smart wit about it, and it was delightful. Do you know what I mean? It was delightful.
But you're actively enjoying the harder it is. I mean, did you have many bad gigs, or could you?
I had. Well, someone said to me early on, and it was the best piece of advice they gave me, and they said, you'll learn nothing from your good gigs, you'll learn everything from your bad gigs. Mm-hmm. And I remember and this was the other thing, I started out stand-up and I kind of went, everything went well. Do you know what I mean? It was like, oh my God, who's this? Let's book her. She's a beginner, but let's book her. And then you get your bad gig and suddenly you go, I don't know what to do. I'm the same person, but it's nothing. And it's a decimating experience, uh-huh. but it is invaluable, because I remember it was in Twickenham,
right?
And I remember getting back on the train, and the whole of the train journey I unpacked what I did and what I could do and what I would do in future, because what I'd never do is get off the stage, because the thing is, if you get off the stage you won't get paid. If you don't do your time, you've got to stand there and do your time. I also learnt what you do in that thing is, if your material isn't working, abandon it. It takes a long time to...
You mean mid-show?
Mid-show. If your material isn't working, abandon it. Don't keep plugging on and then going, oh, why don't you like this? You know, change tack, pick out someone in the audience, do something. Or
ridicule someone.
Yes, ridicule someone. So please, someone say something to me so that I... Because the worst thing that can happen is silence. You've got nowhere to go with silence because it's indifference.
Yeah.
And I do remember the most devastating, and to be fair, it wasn't to me, but it was to this other person. And it was this woman, and it was the most devastating heckle I think I've ever heard. And I've heard some terrible ones, you know, awful, sexist, rude, you know, like your shit, fuck off, you know, all that for no reason at all. Mm. And the worst thing was, mind you, she was a musical act, which can be a little tricky, and the crowd was silent, and someone just shouted out, what do you want? I just remember thinking, you cannot come back from that. No. Because it's a fair question. If you're at a gig not getting any laughs or any response, just, I'm asking merely for information. So I did love the gladiatorial aspect of it.
So you started introducing sort of character monologues within you.
No, I never did that. The only thing I ever did was tell a story about my nan, and I used the old lady voice, and that was all it was. And then suddenly it just set me apart a little bit. Uh-huh. People started to talk about, oh, she does that. But, you know, there was no...
So when you were approached by
like
Jeffrey Perkins from the BBC, yes. when he came up to you in Edinburgh, yes. he saw you doing a stand-up show that just...
No. I did then do, it was because I'd gone to Edinburgh in someone else's sketch show, in Lee Mack's show.
Lee Mack
had a sketch show, and he saw me on the circuit and he said to me, you're good at voices, aren't you? Do you want to do a sketch show?
It was Lee Mack's idea to get you doing these characters.
Yes, it was. It was Lee Mack's idea. I wouldn't have done sketches or anything like that. And then I started working with Lee for a couple of years and loved it, and it was mm-hmm. great. But I was very much the sidekick, you know, because it was Lee's show. And then I'd done that for 2 years, and that was the show we got nominated for the Perrier for. Then I went to the RSC, and then I thought, go back to Edinburgh, because I'd been nominated for the Perrier, or I'd been in a nominated show. Went back to Edinburgh with my own character show.
I see.
And from there, I got the TV show.
Straight away,
yeah.
That's the thing. I was trying to think of anyone else who, out of a clear blue sky, gets their own self-titled TV show.
Yeah.
Was it important to you to have your name in the
title?
No,
it was his idea. It was Jeffrey's idea, actually, because I'd said, I don't want my name in the show.
Right.
He said, oh, no, you absolutely have to. You must. He said, because, for that reason, he said, you're the first woman who's had that since Victoria Wood. And I think she was then probably the only one. I mean, crazily,
yeah.
you know.
But she'd sort of built up to that.
Yeah. With Wooden Waters. And
yeah.
I know. No, I mean, I wanted them to call it, you know, like the Giggle Box or something completely, you know.
generic,
exactly.
Comedy
term. Don't be putting my name to it. But of course, it would have looked strange as to why one person was getting all the, getting all the good lines. And I've got a feeling it was a working title. I remember, like, when we used to rehearse and stuff, it was just, obviously, the project was called The Catherine Tate Sketch Show. And then, and no, it was absolutely Jeffrey's idea. He said, we should call it The Catherine Tate Show. He said, because that's what it is. And and I was thinking, oh, God. I mean, but also, I mean, it's such an extraordinary thing to happen to me that I could never in a million years have thought that was going to happen. I mean, even as we were rehearsing it and filming it, I'd be saying to, like, Nikki and Matt, yeah, it's not going to go on the telly. Yeah, I mean, they're absolutely definitely not going to put this on the telly. Because what a ridiculous thing that was. I mean, I couldn't get my head around it, that it would go on the TV.
And yet it did, and yeah. did very well straight away.
I don't think it did. I think it was a sleeper, and they buried it, you know, in the BBC's wisdom. You know, they didn't really give it much promotion. And when we asked them, we said, why are you not marketing this? And they said, well, no one knows who she is.
Right.
I mean, typical BBC
That's
stuff.
Great.
And then what really jumped it was that I did the Lauren character live on Comic Relief with McFly.
Yes, I remember that.
And
yes.
No one really knew that it wasn't actually
I
happening.
See.
And there was a lot of complaints.
Right.
Saying, why have you let this rude person do this? And then suddenly it really all exploded from there. And because of all the attention on that single thing, the BBC reran the first series and people thought that was the first series, quickly did the second series, and then it kind of exploded.
I see.
Yeah.
Right. And how did that feel to suddenly be, well, how did it feel to be being recognised in the supermarket and all that?
It was it sort of extraordinary.
Mm.
Because it went, and I remember it was a 6-week period where I was doing a play with David Schwimmer at the time. I was doing a Neil LaBute play called Some Girls. And that was over the summer that my second series had come out. And it was in a 6-week period, it suddenly felt like everyone knew who I was.
Right.
And it absolutely jumped up. And it was...
How did David Schwimmer feel about that?
He was very nice. In fact, because we couldn't see the first episode of my second series go out because we were on stage, he did a private screening of it at the hotel where he was at.
Oh,
he,
nice.
He did the
nice.
So we saw it on like a big cinema. So I remember watching my second series go out, sat next to David Schwimmer, and he was howling with laughter. I remember.
Nice.
It's very sweet.
Yeah. I didn't know you at the time, but I felt like suddenly there was a famous person called Catherine Tate.
Mm.
It did seem to happen almost overnight.
Yeah.
And maybe but I probably did the same thing. I probably saw your series on the rerun. Suddenly you were everywhere. There's a mixture of feelings to that, I'm imagining. You know, there's a wonderful sort of vindication.
Yes.
And also there's losing your anonymity is quite scary.
Very scary. I think it is very scary. It's a thing that I think I reconciled early on is that you think, it's a fair enough problem to have.
Of course.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
It's that kind of thing. It's
not necessarily awful. It's just it takes me getting used to.
It takes me getting used to, exactly. And then you get used to it. And then it's when people say, oh, doesn't it get boring when people come up and ask for selfies? Or when, you know, but this happens all the time. And you think, well, it'll be a lot more boring when they stop.
Right, yeah, You became sort of part of the national conversation, didn't you? I mean, Lauren... their schoolgirl character, she was sort of blamed for the dissolution of her youth.
I became
kind of totemic.
She certainly did. I think along with the Vicky Pollard character,
yes.
I think we were blamed for a lot of what was wrong with with broken Britain.
Do you feel responsible?
I can only apologise. But do you know what? And I would always say this to anyone who ever really wanted to levy that charge, ridiculously a comic creation, is I took great pains. Well, not great pains because it came quite naturally, but I was very aware. I never swore as that character.
Mm-hmm.
That character didn't swear. In her own way, she was very erudite. She was eloquent. She was, you know, she had a way with words.
Yes.
She knew she could, well, as you know, she could.
She had a sonnet under her
belt. Yeah. She knew her periodic table.
Yeah.
And she could speak French.
Sure.
And I wanted it to be a take on that, you know, it's funny, but all people see is a girl with a loud mouth. I think that's a bad thing.
Mm.
And as I say when I go into schools, it's not. You need to be heard, whatever it is you're saying. It's better if what you're saying is something, you know, of importance, or at least you feel it's important. But kids need to be heard, because so much of it is like, you know, talk like that. And, you know, it's like it's really, they're down on their phones. I'm like, just be heard, be loud, be loud.
It's so central to the national conversation did she become that you end up doing a sketch with the Prime Minister at the time.
Yes, yes.
And indeed put Lauren's catchphrase in his mouth.
In his mouth, yes. Well,
but how does that come about? I mean, do you phone them up? Do they?
No, I
was
approached.
Does Tony let it be known? He's ready to do comedy now?
I think, had it been at the beginning of Tony's reign, it possibly wouldn't.
Yeah.
Possibly wouldn't. I think it was because you know, it was at the end of the...
The Tony Blair years.
The Tony Blair years. And Comic Relief rang up and said, would you do a...
So I mean,
it was their idea. Right. Yeah. Would you do... And I remember sitting on the stairs and getting this conversation, getting this call and going, sorry, Tony Blair? Tony Blair?
Tony Blair, Tony Blair?
Tony Blair, Tony Blair. And us going in, and we filmed in Downing Street, which we never thought we'd do.
Yeah.
You know, because people very rarely film in Downing Street, or most, even most historical dramas are replicated,
quite.
You know, and we filmed in Downing Street. So all the time when I'm going up saying about, is he a prime minister? Is he a prime minister? That was actually, the stairs at Downing Street. We got a lot more time than we were told we would have because Tony Blair is, of course, the finest comic actor of his generation.
He's very good in
very
that sketch.
Good. He's very good. And he knew that we weren't going to get it in the time that we'd been allotted. And there was a point where it came to him saying, am I bothered? Am I bothered? And he wasn't hitting the right intonation because, let's face it, Tony Blair didn't know who I was, but people around him had said...
Shush, no.
No. I'm absolutely... Why would he have the... I should bloody well hope he didn't know who I was.
He had better
running,
things to do.
Yeah, exactly, running the country. But people around him knew that this was a popular thing to do and it would have, you know, it's for Comic Relief and this is a funny character and you should do this. No, I don't make no coyness about that. No, absolutely. Partly because when I'd come in to say hello, and I think I was talking about my daughter or something like that, or kids and something like that, and he said to the makeup woman, how old is she? Because I think he thought I was a teenager at one point. Do you know what I mean?
He did have the...
I was in a school uniform as I first meet Tony Blair, dressed as one. And so he really had
The Croydon facelift, they call that pulled back hairstyle.
Yes. And she's about 35. And, that was the thing. He couldn't quite get the right intonation.
Okay.
And you could feel in the room people going, oh, God, oh, my God. Because what he was saying was, am I bothered? He was going like that.
Stressing the personal.
Stressing the personal. And it was that moment where you go, oh, God, what are we going to do? But to his immense credit, he knew. And he said, I'm not saying it right, am I? I said, not quite. You're not quite hitting it. And he said to me, tell me how to say it.
Right.
Tell me how to say it. And he parroted it back. And then it worked.
It's a really good sketch.
Yeah.
I watched it again the other day.
It's
fantastic. And that's the thing. At the time, it was to have him saying those words felt like the closing of a circle, didn't it? It felt like something.
Yeah.
It was a really big deal.
Yeah.
With all the success of that, did you then think, well, this is it. I'm sort of Victoria Wood now. Or were you always still thinking, I'm wanting to get back to that sort of doing plays?
Definitely. And, definitely. Right. But it made it a lot harder.
Made it harder?
Well... The thing is, once you are known for being funny, and I'm delighted to know to be known for being funny, it can put you in a box.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a good box to be. It's a nice box to be. But people are reluctant for you to do something that doesn't make them laugh. But I understand I am the person who said I'm bothered. Which then got into the dictionary.
Did it?
Bothered is now in the Oxford English dictionary.
B-O-double-V, is it?
Yeah.
E-R-E-D?
Yeah.
And do you get a little reference in the...
I don't know. I've never seen it. But when I went on, I did 8 hours. I mean, I knew it had happened when it happened because it was Word of the Year and then it got put into the dictionary.
So Word of the Year is a word you have created?
Yes. And then it goes into the lexicon.
Yeah. Must give you a little tickle. Or again, are you just like...
No, I didn't really... None of it ever really registers, I don't think. In fact, it was only... I mean, I'd known it had gone in... But it was only when I did 8 out of 10 Cats Does Countdown that Susie Dent, who is in Dictionary Corner...
Yes, she is.
...and is a wonderful, word historian. Mm. And she said, oh, I'm actually really excited. I've never met anyone who has actually created a word that's gone into the dictionary. And I remember thinking, oh, yeah. But I've never looked it up or anything like that.
You should get T-shirts made or something.
I should, really. But...
And our paths first cross... Your show is at the height of its success and you come and do an episode of Doctor Who.
Yes.
You get smuggled in fact.
Yes, I do.
To do You're one of the only secrets we ever managed to keep.
That's what I remember Julie saying. Yeah, Julie Garner. I remember she saying it was the only secret.
You were the you were the button on the end of my first season.
Yeah.
Where you appear in the TARDIS.
Yeah.
Which then leads us into doing an episode together. But
yeah.
But you were smuggled into Cardiff under cover of night with a hood over your head.
Yep.
In a wedding dress, and we recorded that tiny scene with about four crew members.
Yes.
So it was everyone else was at a wrap party. Yeah. I mean, it was a proper lockdown.
Yeah.
So what tempted you to come and join in? Had you watched any of the new Doctor Who?
Well, the only episode I'd watched, because as I said, it wasn't my thing, but I'd heard...
You'd never seen it as a kid.
No, I had seen it. It was but like tinfoil and stuff.
Right, you paid no attention.
No, and right. I remember, you know, I know the
theme tune.
And A Man with a Scarf and...
Not always.
No, not always. Jelly Babies or something.
Yeah.
And Daleks.
Yeah.
So I knew, but I didn't. And I knew there was a show called Doctor Who. Of course I did.
Yes, it'd be hard to grow up in Britain.
Absolutely. And it was.
But it had no particular
scary. It had no
engagement for you.
Definitely not. Yeah. I don't know that I would have ever necessarily seen a whole episode when I was a kid. I'd heard it was coming back, or it had come back with Russell T. Davis, who I'd love from Queer as Folk.
Yes.
And Chris Eccleston. Okay.
That's right.
So there was a massive, you know, obviously it's a massive big deal. I turn on. And it's the episode about where Rose is a baby.
Oh, yes.
Right? Now, I think that was Chris Eccleston. That wasn't you.
Was.
Yeah. So everything's now set back in the 80s. This is my introduction into the new rebranded Doctor Who.
I see.
And I'm looking on and going, well, it's absolutely shocking. Like, the production values haven't changed at all. This is how I remember it.
I mean, like, they'd set it as a period piece,
yes,
the whole thing.
Yes,
I see.
It had been set as a period piece.
Right.
And I'm like, they've dug up the old costumes.
Quite a fundamental misunderstanding of the show.
A fundamental misunderstanding. And I didn't bother watching it anymore.
Brilliant.
On that
have you
first
ever told
episode.
Russell this?
I don't know if I have. But I do remember thinking, well, this is absolutely appalling. It looks exactly the same as when I watched it when I was a kid. And didn't think anything more about it until you came on. I didn't watch it.
Sure.
But I knew you were on it, uh-huh, and I knew that I thought you were great. And then I got a call to say, would you be in this episode? And I said, I didn't read it or anything. I said, absolutely. Didn't know what the part was or anything like that. I said, absolutely, I'd love to. Then the script comes, you know, it comes with your name on every page,
yes,
doesn't
yes.
it? And I remember opening it because I like to open stuff in the middle and just see
how much you're in it.
See, not even flick through. I like to open it up when I first get a script, open it up and then remember that bit that I've just read. And so when I get to film it, I think, oh, this was the bit I first looked at.
Nice.
And it was, and it said, I knew that the character was called Donna, and it said, Donna is suspended in a massive cobweb in the ceiling wearing a wedding dress. I remember thinking, well, this is something new, isn't it? No, I just said yes and jumped in.
Were you aware of the levels of enthusiasm that this show, it was all new to you?
No, didn't know anything about it. In fact, I actually don't think I realised actually till last year quite how popular the show.
Right. Yes.
And certainly had no idea that my character was popular. Do you know what it was? It was on the first day of filming. Someone said it was a journalist. That's why I don't speak to journalists.
Wise.
They said to me, can you imagine this? The first day of filming, they said, oh, what do you think about all the fan base hating the fact that you're coming back? That was on my first day of filming, going back into the show.
Oh, when you came back as a regular.
When I came back. And I said, oh, I didn't know. So I'm filming the whole show thinking, oh, God. That's why I didn't bother. Well, not that I ever seek to find out. I just kind of thought, oh, well, this is, you know, I'll just enjoy doing it because I loved doing it and I loved playing the character and I loved filming it and I loved working with you and it was great. But all the time I was thinking, oh, no, people are going to be like shouting.
So this journalist had said that he'd found people online saying,
I suppose. I mean, that was all he said to me and I didn't, and I just bothered away.
A fan favourite.
Oh, a firm fan favourite. Oh, yeah. But I had no idea.
Right.
I had no idea.
He was just trying to wind you up.
Maybe, maybe not.
That could have felt rather heartbreaking.
Oh, it was awful. And I remember going back to Russell when he took him off the set.
Quite right too. Where is he now?
Who knows?
It is the Independent. I don't know.
Who knows?
Yes, because you did this one episode and then you came back as a regular.
Yeah.
Which none of us were expecting you to say yes to.
Right.
Julie went off. There was another actress lined up.
Was there really?
I mean, she doesn't know this.
No.
The thing was, Julie Garner, the executive producer, she's going to have lunch with Catherine. She's going to ask her if she'll come back for a whole series. Obviously, she won't.
Yeah.
So on Monday, we're sending out the offer to play this character. Yeah. I mean, there was a character breakdown and everything.
Wow.
It was a sort of formality
that they were going to.
But you thought
you may as well.
Might as well give it a punt.
May as well as wish you had.
Yeah. But did you have a hesitation?
I remember exactly, because you're absolutely right. She took me out to lunch. And my jaw genuinely dropped open because no point was I ever expecting her to say that.
Right.
I just was not expecting it. And I just thought that would be a really good thing to do.
Mm.
Something drew me to it. And it was just strange because it's, as you say, I wasn't tied to the show. It wasn't a thing I felt I wanted to be necessarily more involved with. Apart from when they asked me, because I just thought it was a one-off thing.
Yeah.
I absolutely loved doing The Runaway Bride. How brilliant. But didn't for a minute think.
So you went from a guest character in the Christmas special to having this fully developed history and a family.
Yes, and then it all tying up, which is
testimony
to Russell's genius.
Yes, whether he makes it up as he goes along.
Or plans it all. Exactly.
Who knows? But did you feel that you had to sort of approach it differently? Did it feel like a different character?
No, I didn't at all. Differently, what do you mean in terms of...
Well, I suppose because it went from a sort of one-shot woman in a wedding dress to this character that had...
Yeah. Well, I loved that about it.
Mum and a dad and a granddad.
Yeah. And I also loved that we would get the episodes, you know, on a Thursday and you'd read through them. I loved that we didn't know what was coming.
Mm.
I loved it. Yeah, no, I loved it. I loved doing it. It was...
And you've since discovered the depth of enthusiasm that the show engenders in a way that you didn't really realise.
I had absolutely no idea.
Yeah.
No. I mean, genuinely.
Does it surprise you how much, I mean, when you meet people, you go to conventions and you meet people, is it shocking?
I've certainly experienced things at conventions that I've not really experienced. There's a level of intensity that I hadn't expected. I think you're sort of shocked and, you know, delighted and but amazed at as well, especially. But of course, I mean, I had to really kind of remember stuff because I didn't even remember what I was wearing in the show. And then people come up and say, do you recognize this? You go, why would I recognize that? And it's because they're wearing something I wore, you know, and now I know. I mean, I suppose the wedding dress gave it away a little bit, but it still didn't occur to me that they were dressing as me.
But I've seen people dressed as every costume you wore in that show.
Yeah, yeah.
Your Roman one and
the
your
Roman one,
Agatha Christie the, one.
It's a delightful thing to be a spectator at, I think, because I feel I am a spectator at those events.
Do you? You haven't crossed over into being a Whovian.
I don't think I have. I mean, I do genuinely feel that I am part of something, though.
Yes.
But I just don't know what it... I don't think I know the entire depth that it is I'm part of because they talk about things that I don't know.
Yes.
And when
you're not setting your TiVo box to get the new series. It's not
I'm not. No. I haven't watched it. Well, I don't think I watched it when we were on it,
I haven't watched it ever.
I haven't watched it.
Yeah.
I know it's about, you know, aliens and stuff.
It's a perfect precy.
Yeah, it's about aliens and stuff.
Yeah.
And but it's, you know, it's more about the relationships, I think. And that's what I thought it was about. But I am very amazed at how much people connect with it.
Mm.
And they really do.
Mm.
You know, it's a really, and I don't take that lightly, how much people love the show.
Mm. Well, quite. And there's probably competition for what the first line of your obituary is. Lauren and Donna.
Yeah.
Fighting it out. And obviously with your show and then Doctor Who, it was when we were on stage together doing Much Ado About Nothing that you went off to do a little bit, of course, in the first time you went off to The Office.
Yes.
When you got... Which was also a show you loved, right? The American Office.
Yes.
And you went and did like a similar thing to Doctor Who. You went off to do a sort of
a little bit,
a one-off before going back full-time later.
Yeah. I love the British Office as well. In fact, when the American Office first came out, I resisted watching it for years because I thought, how dare they?
Sure.
And then I absolutely loved
it. It's a different show, isn't it?
It is a different show. It is. Yeah. And no, so that was a lovely experience.
How much of a culture shock was that, doing an American sitcom? Because you said you grew up loving the American shows, and suddenly there you are going on a Hollywood lot every day.
Yeah. The process is surprisingly similar. It's just there's more money involved in, you know, it's just everything has more money thrown at it, it seems to me. And it's a bigger machine. It's a bigger machine. But ultimately, we're all doing the same thing. You know, ultimately, there's only one way to get a shot, and that's cameras being turned on.
So is there a novelty that wears off once you realise that? Or is
I think, yes, I think that there inevitably is when you're in a long-running show.
Yeah.
Even though it's always delightful, it's always fun. And often, I you know, because I don't do shows that last that long usually. Jobs. You know, this was like an 18-month
of course
job, you know, and I'd not really done that before. So I was a little bit, I mean, you get into the groove of it, but then it kind of becomes routine. And
Did you like?
I didn't initially, not because of the place, just because of my situation. You know, it's a lonely place to be, especially Los Angeles. Los Angeles is a place that doesn't give up its secrets easily.
Right.
You can very much feel like an outsider. And I was there entirely on my own, you know, absolutely on my own. And I hated it. I hated it. And then, of course, as it goes, by the time I'd finished that season, you know, I turned a corner and I loved it. And I'd met people and my daughter was out there and my mum was out there and it was all, and we'd got two dogs that we've fostered. You know, it was all fine, you know. But at the beginning, it was brutal and I didn't like it. And it was hard.
And you did two further. You did.
I was across three seasons. Yes. So I did one episode in one, 10 episodes in another, and the entire season of the last one. Yeah,
right. So by the end, you were having a great time.
I absolutely loved it and feel very grateful that I then got introduced to an American audience that way. Because obviously, funnily enough, there are comedy fans, but my show is more like a cult hit out there. And then the Doctor Who, which again has a big following, but again, it's more culty. Mm. But obviously there I was then on a mainstream show that is constantly in syndication and repeated.
Yes.
So most people now know me from Nelly from the Office. Which is
three
funny.
Things competing for the first line of the obituary.
I don't know. I'm not sure that my character from The Office would necessarily be up there. But, you know, it is amazing how TV infiltrates, you know, people's lives.
You've been a jobbing actor, very successful. Yeah. You've also been someone who's created their own stuff. When you're thinking about where you go next, are you always feeling the impetus to be creating something for yourself? Or are you happy to just wait for the phone to ring?
No, because I feel like I have to make the stuff happen for myself. Like, for example, I will always want to do theatre. But I think a lot of people think, oh, she's doing her own stuff, so don't ask her.
I see.
You know what I mean? And so you sort of have to make it known that you want to do stuff. But because of that, I always think, oh, I can't wait for the phone to ring, because, again, I feel like I'll be more productive making stuff happen myself. Mm. And I would love to be the kind of actor that just gets offered great, great stuff all the time. But I don't. I have to make it known what I want to do and then go and make it happen.
And do you have a work ethic that pushes you on? Is there something forged in the...
Yes, fear of failure.
Right.
Absolutely. I mean, not only is my glass half empty, it's not what I ordered. I mean, that is my life, you know, ethic. It's furious. Not only is it not what I ordered, the chip in the rim.
Do you think you need to have that to be funny? Do you think you need to have a cynicism to be funny?
For me, definitely. If I was because I don't think cheerful people, I suppose the thing is, if you delight in everything, you probably don't need to hear laughter anywhere else. But I think because the dark recesses of my mind are so bloody negative, I need to hear laughter just to remind me that it's all
just
right.
Just to open your eyes in the morning.
Yes, just so I need to elicit laughter out of people, I think. What I have is great periods of intensity where I know that the workload that I've created for myself some people may buckle under it, just in terms of the stress that I put myself under.
Mm.
And then I'll do nothing.
Right.
Like nothing. I could sit in my house and do nothing, like nothing for a week.
Yeah.
I wouldn't get bored, and then it would kick in, and then I'd... And I don't think it's even a work ethic that kicks in, it's fear.
Right.
Fear. Fear and negativity.
Fear and negativity. Yes. I think that's a perfect place to end it.
David Tennant Does a Podcast With is a Something Else and No Mystery production. Produced and edited by James Deacon. Additional production from Chris Skinner, Steve Ackerman, Sarah Camlett, Josh Gibbs, Joel Freeman, and Georgia Tennant. Next time.
Oh my God! David, do you have any idea? I would have been literally there the wrong day. Please see attached advance sheet for Saturday. Oh my God, I gotta move some stuff.
Also from Something Else.
Something rhymes with purple. Susie Dent and Giles Brandreth are here to increase your word power as they discuss amazing facts and stories behind phrases and words.
A vexillophile is somebody who's keen on...
flags.
Oh, how did you know that? You just did. You're so clever. Arenophiles.
Okay, well, the word arena comes from sand because the arenas in the Roman amphitheatre were covered with sand to soak up the gladiators' blood.
Correct.
So, anything to do with that?
An arenophile is a sand enthusiast.
Listen now in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and all good podcast apps.